I have a pleasure to introduce a very well-known speaker here. It doesn't require that many things said before he appear on the stage. But first, I would like to, everybody knows Sean Kalishi, and I'm not going to make the list. He is not a doctor, so he cannot be addressed as a doctor, and therefore, right? And therefore, there's not that much to say. He's the brain behind the Oxford Center for Hindu Studies, and he has been the brain for many other things. But first, it's nice to see him using PowerPoint, because he's not. Gradually, I think he's understanding that the people are not going to understand anything of his Irish accent. And therefore, he's giving us the possibility to get something out from his discourse. And he stopped. That's a real improvement. And I'm glad after 20 years, 1991, we got together to know each other. And after 20 years, it's a considerable progress. I'm glad to, and I would like really to make, I appreciate very much your mercy on us to use PowerPoint. Shana Kareishi is with you.
That was one of the most interesting introductions I've ever had. I deserve it. What did I do to you? sorry about this. I have a bad back, so I'm going to sit. Sorry about this.
Sorry. Normally I would jump around the place. I may end up doing that as well.
Oh, don't say what's done. I said. Anyway, I'm here.
Good.
Okay. Right, this is actually a very short presentation. We have until what time?
6:30.
Okay, 6:30. Oh, that's actually even more than I thought. Okay, so it's rather truncated. And I'm supposed to be talking, I do believe. I'm one of these people who gets up to talk about not the thing that they are supposed to be talking about according to the program. But I will not be able to talk about the history of ISKCON education over the last 12 years, you'll be relieved to hear. But we're going to talk about the future. And we're going to talk about it in a very specific way. We were asked to do a project. The Ministry of Educational Development in ISKCON was pushing for a long time for a strategy document for ISKCON education. And we, in ISKCON education, we have been working with a distinct strategy, but with no document. It was just based on a couple of meetings over the years, and the strategy was actually written on one day on a flip chart that didn't exist because someone had forgot to put up the flip chart. So the strategy was developed using pencil fingers in the air, and it was surprisingly effective. And the next strategy was in a restaurant on a serviette. But we have archived the serviette. But anyway, so there was a need for a written strategy document. And it took a long time for us to realize that before we can have a strategy document, we need one step behind that. What is the vision of education? What is essentially the philosophy of education? What is it behind all that? And this is something that Urmila alluded to. The very first point she put in her first slide was philosophy of education. And we don't have one, essentially. Or we have, maybe we don't have one, maybe we have many. But there has to be really, and I don't want to annoy Kamalpriya, but or I'll say something positive about the Germans for a change. When it comes to strategy development, the Germans in the last century were the absolute master. Not only the last century, but the previous century as well. They were the masters of strategy development and execution, with par excellence. Now you can say, well, they lost two world wars, so it wouldn't seem like that. But in actual fact, they survived in two world wars against huge armies for an awfully long time, when there's no way that they should have survived for so long. And they did it by some simple processes that are continually studied in military academies and in organizational fields. They were able to succinctly put their strategy on one sheet of paper, and that's what a commander in the field received. One sheet of paper said everything that they had to know, and they had to execute the tactics according to their genius, and that was what their training was for. Now we look on the German and the Prussian military machine as authoritarian, while in actual fact the officer class were not authoritarian. The officer class, when sitting around doing planning, a lieutenant could contradict a general by just saying, but what about such and such? So a very open, broad-minded system. But the idea of being able to produce one sheet of paper, you know, very simple ideas that this is what we stand for, and that the commander in the field has to read that and find himself in it, and use this as the basis of innovation, creativity, resourcefulness, and getting the job done. So that's actually not an easy thing to do, and you need to develop a culture of strategy development. So the philosophy behind it, you know, why are you doing this thing, that becomes the very basis of all kinds of people being able to develop their own strategies, or even more importantly, develop tactics. How do you execute this in the field? And the difference between strategy and tactics is there's a plan to do, to go and do one thing, and then you ring up someone in, I don't know, London and say, our international plan is such and such, and then they decide how to deal with that locally. With all the resources in an English-speaking world, the local laws, blah, 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 blah. So it has to be transmitted in such a way. Now, the contrary to that was the British and American approaches, where, on the whole, they were given reams of documents before a battle, and they were told that this is how you have to execute it. So the tanks would all go down one kind of causeway in the middle of a field, and the Germans had it pinpointed, and they would just pick the tanks off one by one, and they couldn't stop moving forward until they got an order to tell them to do that, which was disastrous in many cases. Oh, I was going to use it. I was the only person in the whole conference that's actually going to use that. There you go. There is a vote. So what we've done is we have come up with life as a cycle. Life is a cycle. What we've done is we've come up with a draft document. A philosophy of education document. So a draft was produced this May in Oxford, and members of the ISKCON Studies Institute sat together and kind of bet up that draft, and we've come up with a second draft that I'm going to present to you here today. And this document has to be as universal and inclusive as possible so that we can produce something that everyone can identify with, can understand. Now, unfortunately, it has to be done on one sheet of paper, but because of the nature of the beast, this isn't a military strategy. This is a philosophy of education. It has to be necessarily brief, sutra form, more or less. Each statement that we make has to go along with an essay that actually explains it. And we would envisage that this essay writing process will continue onwards and onwards and onwards. That the development of education becomes a process of cultivation by intelligent people. It doesn't stop with the statement, but the statement has to be the basis of the discussion. So that's what we're trying to develop. Okay, we will go to the next slide. These are six areas that we're dealing with. There's going to be short statements. I'm just going to read them out. And I just like it. I just like feedback. And also, if you don't understand it, or if you don't think it's inclusive enough, or you don't think it's making a point, please feel free to make suggestions, criticize, analyze, depress me, whatever you want to do. So one is a basis for education, just establishing the philosophical basis of education, the kind of what's behind it all. Two is the virtues of education. Three is dealing with the concept of the teacher, the student, values of education, and developing education. So these are just some areas that we've got. Now, these can all be merged, eradicated. You know, we can do whatever we like with them to some extent. Basis for education. So, straight in. For ISKCON, the starting point of thoughtfulness and learning is the self. Self-satisfaction, the impetus, with instruction by example and experience being the foundation of self-development. Actually, I was very interested just in the whole conference because I was waiting for someone to say something that would totally rock this and make me have to change the whole thing, and I didn't find any such input, so that's a relief, and thank you all very much. So that's the starting point. What do you think, then? Does that make sense? It's all self-evident, more or less? Nick?
I would just give that what is the purpose of education?
Uh-huh.
Why are you
aiming
to achieve through education?
That's going to come out throughout the whole thing. Yeah. Yeah, thank you. But let's revisit it. Don't let me off the hook on that. If I haven't satisfied that, so go on. Just say I still don't know why we're doing this. One point here is the concept of self-satisfaction being the impetus. That's a major part of it. It's the self thing is obvious. The starting point is thoughtfulness and learning of the self. There's an individual involved. Self-satisfaction being the impetus is basic. I would use the word Vedic. Haha, it's actually Vedic, and it's also Bhagavat. And the Vedic side of it is in the first text of the Rig Veda. We have the word karma. The concept of desire is the fundamental philosophical point coming from the Rig Veda. In doing this, I have to say, I did little seminars with David Karacharya and Professor Tripathi, Professor Rukmani, Patrick Olliville, just anyone who could get my hands on passing through Oxford, and sat down and I was intrigued to discover that the Vedas actually has philosophy and the basis of the philosophy that we see discussed in all subsequent texts, and how Acharyas are on the whole very faithful to Vedic philosophical concepts. And that wasn't something I was aware of before. So the concept of self-satisfaction, unless a person's individual desire is satisfied at some point in the line, happiness isn't going to happen. And self-satisfaction from the Vaishnava point of view and of course, you know, the Bhagavad Gita is all about this theme of desire is very strong. And self-satisfaction in the Srimad Bhagavatam is Savai Pum Samparodano Yutavakir Hakshe Yayatma Supersedati. So, in the definition of religion and bhakti, then that the self is completely satisfied. So, it's something that in classes on that text, which is a very important text. I just haven't heard people focus on the satisfaction of the self. It seems like a strange formulation, you know, self-satisfaction. Well, that's not something we talk about a lot. But actually, from a good thinking point of view, unless the self is satisfied, people aren't going to do anything about it, you know, unless there's something in it for us. And then the definition of the self, of course, is important. Okay, will we move on? The idea of self is holistic and defines our existence and identity in the physical, mental, intellectual, and spiritual spheres. And that's kind of hearkening back to the Rig Veda as well, because the concept of Atman that appears in the Rig Veda isn't simply a spiritual concept. It has become, the word Atma becomes used more as a spiritual concept in the Upanishads, and very definitely in the Bhagavad Gita. But at this stage, it's looking at the self, the Atma, and still people use Atma as the mind, etc. So it's acknowledging the spiritual as the eternal self. Consideration must be given to each sphere in order to provide a satisfying, balanced, and holistic education. And the concept of holistic also rears its head in the Rig Veda. I think we'll get into that later. How is that kind of okay? We find in Vedic thought, we mentioned the word God, the starting points of our search for meaning in the world. Reflection on these ideas help us find ourselves in the greater whole, helps us realize our interdependence on others and to express ourselves responsibly in our relationships. Now, there are some important ideas in this in terms of, well, that was Nick's point, a purpose of education. Finding ourselves in the greater whole, that's about Dharma, essentially. So the concept of ethics rears its head in ISKCON, helps us realize our interdependence on others, though we've been discussing integration, interculturalization, alien identities, and that kind of stuff. This is recognizing that that's just a fact. You can't not recognize others, and to express ourselves responsibly in our relationships, establishing relationships as an important aspect of our worldview. And all this kind of thought comes from the concept of Ritta in the Rig Veda. Now, Ritta is elaborated as Dharma. It appears in the Rig Veda as well, Dharma, but more in the Upanishads. But the concept of Ritta is important for us to understand because, as I mentioned here, Vedic thought. So I think we can all agree that the Rig Veda is a Vedic text, and Ritta is a Vedic thought. And this idea of Ritta, it means cosmic order, simply. That there's a cosmic order. If we appreciate thinking philosophically, if there is a cosmic order, then we have a place within it. So that's our starting point, in a sense, dealing with the world. We're a very small cog in a big machine. So we look out at the beauty of nature and how the manifestation of its complexity, the systems that it works in, and it's just, you know, mind-bogglingly complex and vast, and we're only a very small cog in a very big machine. But that very small cog consciousness means that we're aware that every other person we meet is also a very small cog in the same machine. They have their place. That's their place to play. That's their dharma. So every individual has their own path. They have their own dharma. They have their own ethical perspective. They have their own spiritual perspective, because the Atma is also individual. So it helps us realize our interdependence on others. Automatically, as a small cog in a big machine, we're automatically interdependent on the machine and every other cog. And to express ourselves responsibly in our relationships, we have to find our place in the bigger schemes of things. Otherwise, we become part of a problem, not a solution. We're not part of the machine. We're ignoring the necessity of this cog doing its job so that everything clunks around that little bit. So that's kind of where this comes from. So it's going back to a very, very old idea that, interestingly, has developed itself as Dharma, but Dharma doesn't quite express Ritta. Because this has bigger implications philosophically for us. The idea of expressing ourselves responsibly in the relationships, if you're a small cog in a big machine, your starting point is to be a servant of the greater whole. That's very, very much Indian thinking, very Buddhist, very Jain, very Hindu, very, very Sikh. And we find it, you know, permeated throughout our Western Gaudiya Vaishnava culture because of this thinking. So all the acharyas are all pointing back to a certain worldview, a certain starting point. Now the Western starting point is quite different. The West has developed the idea that we are the master. And that's interesting itself. Ritta has another word associated with it called Ritu, which means seasons. The concept of cycles, that everything is working in cycles. The West, again, has this kind of linear historical approach. So, as I said, philosophically, this word it deserves a little bit more thought, because very, very basic worldview philosophical concepts that are important to us come from this starting point. So the starting point is to be a servant. That's whether you're involved in spiritual life or material life. This is just considered common sense. Ritta is about dealing with the world. It's not necessarily a spiritual concept. Okay. I think that's enough on that. Is there any questions on that? No. This is kind of what...
Very interesting point on this term, Ritam. Ritam concept in the Vedic terms before the Dharma. Mm-hmm. And Dharma is based on Ritam, because Ritam is righteousness, right? Even the right, the concept of the right,
yeah.
of the right, modern right, for rectus in Latin, is coming from Ritam, which is also a ritual how to get in contact with the truth.
Yeah, thank you. Yes, very good. Another interesting thing, just before we leave Ritta, is the R with a dot under it in Ritta, Rit is means upness, as David Karacharya was saying, that this was something that he found fascinating in his youth, that the concept of upness, meaning that heaven is up there, we go up the greasy hole, you know, everything desirable is up. So there's this natural imperative to upness, and from this comes the concept of the gunas, with the sattva being the beginning of the taxonomy, that goodness, purity, all these things are up. They're the things to be aspired for. And Angelica Maloner, another scholar, she discerned in 2 years of fieldwork in Bengal that she would go to a village, and everywhere she went in Bengal and Orissa, it doesn't matter if people didn't know what their religion or sampradaya was, couldn't express themselves, articulate themselves, everyone would respond to the concept of sattva. That everyone was aspiring for the best thing, the highest thing, the purest thing, the good thing. Everyone understood this concept, even though there's not a lot written about it. There's not a lot written about Ritta either. But these are concepts that are worldviews that have dictated for an awfully long time how the East thinks. And I would also postulate, as they say, that the concept of pluralism, as we understand it in the Indian context, so it's famous for being pluralistic, even though modern Indian nationalistic politics wouldn't betray that fact very easily. But it also comes from the same idea, the thinking behind it. Okay. And then we find that the practice of bhakti brings another level of quality to our learning and our understanding, one of love and service with devotion. Pure bhakti, the mood of service to Lord Krishna, as defined by the Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, could have said, defines ISKCON and infuses ISKCON's approach to education. So then, coupled with this Vedic philosophical point, I'm so happy to be able to say Vedic philosophy. I've railed against the word Vedic for years. I actually found something in the Vedas that I can use that is actually Vedic. And the concept of bhakti, marrying these two things together. So the philosophical worldview and the approach to the world with the spiritual approach to Krishna, one. And the important thing, of course, being Prabhupada's definition of bhakti as devotional service, as an activity. So it's not just some vague concept of love. It's actually a dynamic action. Love, in that sense, being demonstrably a verb. Okay? And I've made a bold statement that pure bhakti is defined by Prabhupada, defines ISKCON. As we've heard earlier on, no one has defined ISKCON. I just did it, and no one said anything. There you go. You can say what you like in this kind of things. Thus, service with devotion and knowledge are the basis of ISKCON's culture and of its educational development. So this idea of Vairagya Vidya Nija Bhakti Yoga, of Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya. So the knowledge part being the philosophical perspective and the devotional perspective, both together form the basis of culture. You can't have one without the other for proper development. We are arguing. Is that okay? Is there any questions, comments, morbid thoughts? Virtues of education. The effect of education is the awakening of our relationship with Lord Krishna, the drawing out of self-awareness and our service attitude, and nurturing natural virtues of humility, honesty, compassion, and tolerance. I haven't mentioned geography, history, or mathematics, and that's not really what this philosophy of education is about. That's a different level of discussion, the discussion of curriculum. But this is the, as I say, the virtues of education. What are we trying to instill? What are we trying to... And that's kind of getting back, hopefully, to the purpose of education. And I've said that these virtues of humility, honesty, compassion, and tolerance are natural virtues, certainly universal. Okay? That's also evident. Personal choice is also important. The choices we must make in order to discern Dharma, how to do the right thing and how to do it right. Choosing noble principles, developing character with integrity, and concern to find our contribution to help develop our virtues. So So these natural virtues that I've just mentioned, that are all mentioned in Vaishnava texts repeatedly, we're just hinting that it's important that students understand that they can develop these virtues during their life by discernible processes, and not only that, but it's their choice to do that. That the student has always choice, and unless the student makes the personal choice, there is no education. And that is, of course, in the explanation of this in an essay, the Bhagavad Gita, where Arjuna has his nervous breakdown and surrenders to Krishna. He says, fix me up. And Krishna, and that's kind of, we're in a really difficult situation and we're just totally fried and we don't want to think about it anymore, and we approach someone and says, just help me. The most frustrating in the world, thing in the world would be if someone said, well, on the one hand this, and on the other hand, he's just giving us, we just want someone just to help. That's actually what Krishna did. He just gave him all kinds of choices, some of them atheistic, some of them kind of funny, and goes through all kinds of yogas, and at the very end, and makes it very clear what he favors, what he thinks that Arjuna should do if he was smart, and being his friend and being his devotee. But at the end, as Nick pointed out very well, Nick's favorite verse, do deliberate on this fully, and then do what you wish to do. So this is our example. This is God talking. So he could have just said, I am the Lord your God. You will wake up in the morning and you will go out and do 1, 2, 3, 4 and come back and report. And I want the report and certificate. Do it.
No.
But he didn't. He had this discourse. He gave his opinion. And as Nick says, frustrating the Muslims. God having his, this is my opinion. This is my opinion. And he had lots of opinions. And again, frustratingly. And gives him a choice at the end. But it's when we see the development from a philosophical point of view, this is totally in line with Ritta, where the individual has to find their role to play, their dharma, what cog in the machine they are. But also, in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna is inviting Arjuna into a loving relationship. And that can't take place unless Arjuna has personal choice. So Krishna, there's no way that Krishna's going to take away personal choice. Arjuna has to have personal choice. And going back to 2.12 in the Bhagavad Gita, that never was there a time when I did not exist and you knew all these kings, that the individual is eternal. So from the point of view of merging into Krishna, or that Krishna created us, Krishna is saying, no, that's not the case. This is a different perspective. There's no way that you can merge into me because you are eternally an individual. So you you always have the choice to love me. I didn't create you. You existed eternally. So, it's absolutely down to your choice. If you break your leg tomorrow, don't blame me. You made the choice. And that's so the concept of theodicy in Christianity that plagues these traditions that, God has created us. So ultimately, when push comes to shove, when things get really nasty, then you just turn around to God and say, well, it's all your fault. I used to do that with my mother, and, I say, I didn't ask to be born. When my mother said, I bore you in my womb for 9 months. You have a mother? Everyone have a mother like that? No? That was heavy, wasn't it? But it seems Irish mothers go to a certain school where they have these mantras. And then we have to say, I didn't ask to be born. Who's the creator? Krishna's point is that for the self that we mentioned earlier on, there is no creator. This is an eternal individual. Okay? Anything else with this? Any questions? Education is distinct from training. Requires challenge and innovation and an invitation to reflect, resulting in independently thoughtful students. Prabhupada says that he wanted to produce independently thoughtful devotees, and we're suggesting that education as distinct from training. It's interesting to reflect on the British Empire. Well, that's not really interesting. As an Irishman, we don't like to reflect on it very often. But it did some things very well, and it controlled India very well. It educated its civil service. Now, what subjects do you educate imperial civil servants in, if you wanted to control an empire, what subject areas would they be educated? They were all educated in Oxford, bless them. So what would you educate them in? Any suggestions from those who don't come from Oxford?
Law.
What's that?
Law.
Law. Anything else? What other subject? You want someone to run an empire? Give me a subject. None of you ever wanted someone to run an empire. Language?
History.
Accountancy. Man with his head screwed on. What they educated them in was language. They educated them in Sanskrit and a local language, an indigenous Punjabi, Tamil, Bengali, Gujarati, etc., wherever they might be posted. Sanskrit, why? It's the language of the Brahmins. If they can speak Sanskrit, they are as good as Brahmins. And that's exactly how they were respected. Very smart British, I hate to say it, but got to give it to them. And what subject area? Classics. So the Iliad, the Odyssey, the Bible, Shakespeare, all that kind of literature. Just literature, such ancient literature from different lands. Stories, on the whole. But the fact is, it was education they were giving them, not training. They could hire accountants, they could hire lawyers. The law there was different anyway. But when they were on the northwest frontier, facing the Pathans, much like the British are today, in fact. How were they going to deal with that? There was no email, you couldn't get word back. They had to think on the spot and make a decision. And they were surprisingly effective at doing that. And their resource was this wealth of knowledge, wealth of stories that they could reflect on and take out some good ethical, good managerial point, good example, which they did, as I said, very, very effectively. And they were surprisingly effective in that most troubled part of India, more effective than anyone has been since, because of good education. So education as distinct from training. So this is how you develop independently thoughtful people. Okay? And that's a desire. The teacher. Educational qualification is essential in a formal educational environment. Yet the teacher's principal virtue is a personal sense of devotional service to Lord Krishna in this context. Their principal teaching method is through personal example and concern for their students. So that's, it's simply put, but hopefully it kind of makes a point. Any issues there? Is that self-evident? In every country you go to, there'll be a different educational training system, etc., etc., etc. But what do you want the students to see? I mean, we all know, and it's the Socratic method and everything, that the student will do what you do, not what you say. So if that's the case, and certainly on reflection, it was my case when I went to school. There were certain teachers I was very impressed with because I was impressed with them as people. Therefore, I took the subject seriously. And I'm sure many have had that example. But it's the personal example of the person. And the deeper that personal example, you know, if it comes from a more substantial place, it helps the student understand that there is a substantial place. And concern for their students. I think that's an absolute prerequisite. Maybe it's just common sense, but should be said. Cultivation of devotion, knowledge, and renunciation have been traditionally acknowledged as the most valuable attainments in a Vaishnava. And those who have attained these as society's teachers, thus practice is valued over precept and virtue over qualification in a life well lived. So that's to do with the issue of example, as the essential point of example. And the concept of a life well lived rather than some big qualification in life. I mean, as we said, if you're going to teach, you have to be educationally qualified. But rather than looking for other forms of qualification, other levels of success, the level of success for a teacher, traditionally, and I would say to this day, is that the person is living a life that is exemplary, that is just a life well lived. And there's many examples people have bumped into, humble people. So that's just acknowledging that kind of nobility. Okay. Anything? Is this okay? Is this as boring as hell? I haven't cracked a single joke. No? Okay. The student is at the heart of ISKCON's educational approach. The student-centered approach is personal, nourishing, and empowering. Then that's an important statement. By discerning and nurturing the normal, natural qualities and skills of a student, formation and transformation can be effected based on healthy student-teacher relationships. If it's a student-centered approach, it's not essentially an ISKCON-centered approach in terms of the institution, a guru-centered approach, etc., etc. And that's important to maintain the integrity of the teacher-student relationship, so that the teacher and the student can develop the bond necessary to get on with it. The student-teacher relationship is an important bond founded on respect, service, and the desire to receive blessings. Now, that's a strange construction of words, maybe, but the desire to advance is just putting the apple on the teacher's desk, just wanting that favor. It's an emotional relationship, and that to be effective, that can't be ignored. The concern of student-centered education is that aside from any other benefit of learning, the student develops thoughtfulness, self-confidence, self-discipline, and social awareness. We can ask the question, what's a society, but not here, and all those questions. How does this lie? Okay, we'll go on. It's not usual for me not to get some kind of response, getting depressed. Okay, values of education. ISKCON education is driven more by the vision of mission than the implementation of mission, recognizing the vision to be universal and the implementation to be bound by time, place, and circumstance. It is more concerned with the development of the person than the institution, the person being the driving force of the institution. It values quality over quantity, consistent with concern for the person, the student. Do they all ring true? Does someone think that those values are strange? Does anyone understand what I just said?
Is there anyone there?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Okay, education is driven by the vision of mission is quite, I hope that's straightforward. But it's not about process, the implementation of the mission. So the vision of the mission is something that can be easily transferred and is inspiring and enthusing, and everyone can get. The implementation of mission is just a process, and you can say it's all about book distribution, it's all about Harinam, it's all about something else, but that's not the vision of the mission, they're the processes of the mission. So that's a little superficial. And in another parlance, that's their tactics, and strategy is what the mission is actually trying to achieve. So to give someone a vision means that they're empowered to do something with it in whatever time, place, and circumstance manifests before their eyes. So no matter where they are, they should be able to deal with the situation and implement the mission. But the reason why we say this is there is a dialogue or a conflict between vision and implementation of mission. Not only in ISKCON, in practically every organization I've come across. And it just needs to be stated clearly that vision is more important, thought is more important, and heart as well. It is more concerned with the development of the person than the institution. Seems like self-evident, but it's not actually self-evident in practice in most institutions. And without stating this clearly, it's very easy to lapse into the institutional need. You know, my mother just passed away, I need to go to the funeral. No, you need to wash the pots for Buddha. You know, that's Krishna's need, that's your need. You know, and this kind of thing. That's not dealing with the person. That's dealing with the needs of the institution. And so, as I say, I'm just giving a small example. You'll all have your own examples. And so some ISKCON temples will have a philosophy of being more centered on the person, some more on the institution. But that inconsistency causes its own confusion. You can't really afford to have such inconsistency in an educational institution, especially dealing with younger children. It needs to be clear from the start, and then they learn that message for themselves and quality over quantity. And again, that might seem like a simple thing to say, but but because I'm from Ireland, it was the Celtic Church and the Roman Church, and St. Patrick came to Ireland to make everyone Christian. The fact is, there were an awful lot of Christians in Ireland at the time, but they weren't Roman Christians. So he came actually to convert the Roman Christians, the Celtic Christians, to Roman Christianity. That was his primary mission. And one of the big issues with Rome was that it was baptizing people at birth, and that was a numbers game, a quantity. And the Celtic Church has found the Judaic method of allowing people at the age of between 12 and 14 to make their own decision. So it's just, it's a quality over quantity issue. So I'm just saying that, you know, that won out. The Celtic Church didn't win, by the way. It doesn't exist. It was obliterated. But that's what was happening at that time. And that can continue to happen. So the Kumari mentioned seeker points and things like that. They have been an issue in our society, important to mention. Okay, developing education. The first question of ISKCON's, this is the last one, of ISKCON's educational development revolves around teachers and their education. The second question concerns curriculum, and the third, infrastructure and resources. Planning should be conducted as if we were to live forever, long-term and sattvic. The last point is very important because short-term planning is usually conducted based on resources, etc., and not on vision. And we've already said that vision is the driving force. So if it's not long-term, then you're not actually setting in plan, setting in train a sustainable plan of education in whatever area you try to do it. And the why we say that it's not generally when we like they've just built Krishnavanti School in England, the first Hindu state-funded school, and it's wonderfully built. It really is fantastic. But their first question wasn't who are the teachers. The first question was how do we build the infrastructure, get planning permission and all that kind of thing. So they went to number three. So it does have to be stated that you do have to think. So now they have this wonderful Hindu state-sponsored school with a dearth of Hindu teachers. So they may have to end up getting a Jewish teacher. You know, it has there are real issues involved here. What is your educational program for training your teachers? That has to be the first question. And Romola's point about curriculum, after X number of years, ISKCON hasn't developed its own curriculum. Now, as to whether it needs to speak in 19 different languages, no. The curriculum develops the way it develops. It's the second point. And planning, and the infrastructure is the third point. So that's what we are suggesting. It is recognized that different areas have different laws and norms which define how educational practice can develop. By promoting personal creativity, responsibility, commitment, and devotion, we encourage students and teachers to use all their genius and talent to develop their ways of teaching and learning according to time, place, and circumstance. So we're passing the baton over to others. ISKCON is not saying that we can solve all your problems. It's saying that you have to solve your problems in your local area. You have to learn how to do this yourselves and use your own genius. And your own talent. So this is meant to be empowering, you know, to say that you have the genius, you have the creativity, then use it and the responsibility. And that's really ISKCON has in the past tried to control education on all levels, and without effect. We can understand our students educationally as. Our subject educationally as a cycle. We begin as students depending on teachers who begin and continue as students. It's a very simple statement. It's very kind of Rita idea, but we just thought it had to be said because it is education in that sense, is a cycle. But having said that, it's also a pyramid. So we can understand our subject socially, not educationally, but socially, as a pyramid which begins at the top, a space populated by the most intellectually and spiritually gifted of our society. In order to develop society as soundly as possible, society has an obligation to facilitate the top of the pyramid as a priority. That was shared with me by Professor David Patterson in Oxford, who founded the Centre for Jewish and Hebrew Studies. And he said, a new revelation or anything. But it's a nice way to understand society per se. But also when we think of it in terms of the Vedic society that we talk about in our books that may not be as Vedic as the Rig Veda. Vera has given lectures to us on this before, shaken our tree. But this idea of support for the Brahmins, which we've been tremendously unsuccessful at in this time. I mean, if we were to make money on being unsuccessful, we would have done so well. But we haven't been good at that. But that is the Vedic, that is when Prabhupada uses the word Vedic and Vedic society, he is talking about primarily facilitating Brahmins and Vaishnavas. And Brahmins in this understanding are intellectuals. So they're not necessarily all Vaishnavas, but they are the people who can think things through. And with Brahman comes the qualities and the guna and the karma. So Samodha, Matapasa, Chantra, Arjuna, which are all these wonderful qualities of peacefulness, self-control, purity, tolerance, obviously wisdom and religiousness that we find in Gopinath Acharya, for instance. So he told me one day that he has all these kind of people. I don't want to argue with him, he's got really weak hands, isn't he? But anyway, so that's kind of, in terms of social development, if we want sound social development, if Prabhupada Bhakti Siddhanta said we should have a Vedic society of some kind, someone will have to define what that means. And again, 40 years later, nobody has defined that in any satisfactory manner. No one has taken any form of leadership in this. And this can only come from sound study and discussion, and there's a quality to that study. And conferences like this are beginning to help us understand the quality of scholarship that we need to be able to develop this further. So that's it, folks. That is just us trying to develop a philosophy of education. This is draft number 2. We are happy to go into draft number 3, 4, 5, and 6. This has taken about 3 years to get here. Our interfaith statement took 4 years in development. We went through a lot of consultation with some very, very good people, many of them not devotees, and this will be tested in that way as well. What do you think? Typical Scottish.
Well, I just have a question to understand better. Like, what state status does that have? Like, I mean, speaking for ISKCON, are you trying to eventually get the GBC to adopt this, or like, where are we heading?
But this is actually commissioned by the Ministry of Educational Development some years ago, which was, and they commissioned a strategy document, and I was part of a team that developed the strategy, so that, you know, obviously it fell on our lap. And but then we came back to them and said, well, we actually first need a very simple and coherent philosophy of education, and then we can give you a strategy document. And this is the result. So it's commissioned by the GBC body, ministry, which was dissolved by the GBC last March, but there is a successor body that has all the same members on it. So I don't even know what the name of that body is, but I'm supposedly a member. But this work, I mean, I have confirmed that this work is going on, and Shesha Prabhu as GBC for Education, and we all banded together at the same time. And he's championing this, and with a lot of GBC support. So this is, you know, we're, as is usual the kind of things we do, we're ending up able to make a real contribution to the society if we want to.
Yeah, I was just wondering, like, in getting this through, and how much force, you know, how much convincing there needs to be done. But what struck me when you just talked about it was that perhaps you wouldn't need to start the basis for education, but rather perhaps the virtues. Like, as a rhetorical strategy, you always start with pathos first in order to get your audience convinced. And I noticed that also in the virtue section, you talk about ISKCON Shabhama, which might go well down people like in the beginning. And then once you like enthuse them for your vision, because it all sounds really good, then you can give the basis and then get the law out of them, and people are equal to be convinced.
Very good point. Excellent, thank you very much. That's a very good, very good feedback. Anything else? Any responses?
Just a quick question about quality over quantity. You mentioned you shared with us the history of Celtic Christianity and Roman Christianity and how that happened. But when we discuss quality here, what we are talking about and what's the criteria for judging quality?
Well, I think that's going to be based, that's on a case-by-case basis. So what I would hate to happen is a law book of education or some such aberration. This necessarily has to be very brief to be comprehensible. And the essays that come out of it, we want to develop essays with its publication so that people understand that commentary is important. We need to tease this out, continually tease this out. But the basic statement, quality over quantity, means that all the qualities that we have discussed should not be compromised. So the integrity of the statement itself, as we say, maybe beginning with virtue, should not be compromised, so that we understand, so that in the name of quantity, you don't compromise quality. And you can have as much quantity as you like, as long as the quality is protected. That's the meaning and the spirit of it. I'll just keep it as simple as we can. Anything else? Anyone else? No?
Doesn't sound like it. Well, thank you very much for that, Shankar.
Thank you.